This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we now go live to Istanbul, Turkey, where we are speaking with Karen DeVito. She is one of the travelers on the most recent trip to Gaza for international concern for sovereignty, Palestinian rights, humanitarian aid, and other issues. She has just been returned to Istanbul, Turkey, where she is with her husband, John. And she has gone through an ordeal of being abducted on the high seas, of being falsely imprisoned, made to pay extra and excessive travel expenses, and prevented from going to Gaza. It is quite an honor to have you with us, Karen DeVito. How are you?
Hello, Robert. Well, thank you for having me. It's good to hear a New York voice.
You are a Vancouver resident, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Well, we are...
I'm a Vancouver resident, but born in New York State and misspent a lot of my youth in the city.
Well, I see you're still getting into trouble.
Yes, I'm still.
You have just emerged from an ordeal. You have been under Israeli occupation, as it were, with the seizure of the ship. I believe you were on the Tahrir en route to Gaza.
Yes, the Tahrir.
Tell us how this trip began for you, why you did it, and what happened in the middle of the ocean.
Well, first, I'd like to back up and thank the Turkish people. They really have an understanding of standing up for human rights and for the Palestinians' right to self-determination. And I'm really glad to be here. I'm glad that they welcomed me back so graciously after that ordeal. You know, Robert, what brought me there was just a question of conscience. I think this happens for a lot of people. I had been reading and writing about peacemaking in divided societies. And this, I picked this particular issue. It spoke to me one day. Your conscience asks you the question. An opportunity to act comes up, and your conscience says, is this right? And as Dr. King has said, you act not because it's safe or because it's political or it's politically acceptable, but you act because it's right. And I think that's probably the same answer that many people who are on the ship would give you. You want to hear the interesting stories, I guess, about what happened to us. Well, you know, Turkey did allow our ship to sail, although that was not a given. As you know, the blockade's been outsourced quite far over the Mediterranean, so right until the moment we sailed, we weren't really sure whether we were going to be able to do this. You know, we pretended to be tourists on a day trip to Greece, and Israel pretends to be the only democracy in the Middle East. Well, you know, there are others. I'm speaking to you from another. The Israeli military pretends to be the peaceful and orderly military. They pretend that they restore peace and order, but what we experienced out there on the high seas was violence and disorder. What a mess. Three large warships, 10 or 15 smaller boats, including inflatable boats, two with water cannons, all the crafts bristling with armed commandos, air fighter planes flying overhead, all to capture a bunch of peaceniks with one boat just on a goodwill mission and a solidarity mission, and the other one with a bit of medical aid just because we had the space. So it was a pretty surreal experience. I have to say that these soldiers they sent, when we finally saw their faces, they were very, very young. They were just kids, maybe used as a training exercise. It looks like that's what it was, but gosh, I hope they do better next time. It was really chaotic.
You speak about there coming a moment of making a right decision and your trip on the Tahrir to Gaza being part of that, and yet We here cannot forget that the graciousness of the Turkish government in the light of the loss of their citizens in the other incident earlier this summer. I believe more than a half dozen people killed by Israeli troopers who boarded the
It was nine people, actually.
Contingent. Nine people.
Yeah. A friend of ours was the Canadian on the boat, and he had smuggled out a camera chip. He had taken pictures. He took photographs of the bodies. When you see these photographs, they're tough to look at, but when you see them, you know that people were executed. At least three of them were shot in the head. One of the first people to be shot was a journalist who was shot in the forehead as he was filming. These photographs were used by the Turkish government, and then they were returned to Kevin. It's partly for these people who couldn't go home to their families after their humanitarian mission that many of us went. We know that there wasn't intent to harm us. We knew that there was a lot of care that was going to be exercised by the IDF, the Israeli military. However, from what I saw, there was a lot of chance for an accident. In other words, he had some really untrained people in a really awkward situation after they corralled our boats with the other ships, making a tighter and tighter corral until ultimately the Irish boat, in trying to get away, reversed to get some ground to make a run for it over the waves they had created. And there wasn't enough room. Our ships collided. Everything was heaving all over the place. Shortly after that, we were boarded. So the commandos came onto the ship, were shouting orders at us. Before they boarded, they were shouting at us through a megaphone, go to the back of the ship. No, go to the front of the ship. And we'd go to the front, and the water cannon would be spraying us. So we'd go behind the wheelhouse, and they'd say, get to the front of the ship. We'd say, turn off the water cannon. They'd turn it off. We'd follow their instructions, and they'd spray us again. It was really crazy. Boarded the ship. We were mostly huddled by the wheelhouse. They told us to go to the back, and they told us to stand up. They told us to sit down. They told us to lie on the deck. We were trying to do all of these things at once, as they told us immediately, with our hands in the air. And, you know, it really, I think, the idea that there could be an accident and one of us could get shot was really scary, and I knew that was a possibility. A couple of our people were roughed up in the wheelhouse. David Heap was tasered. Later he said, although it did hurt, wasn't too effective at tasering because, you know, when you fire a water cannon on steel decks, the decks get really slippery. So the soldier who tried to taser him slipped and fell. Didn't do a good tasering job. But still, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Someone pulls a trigger when they don't mean to. We sat below afterwards with the guys who were guarding us were really nodding off. They looked like they'd been up for 48 hours, maybe took drugs to do so. Their eyes looked very strange. One of the fellows was playing with his gun and turning the laser sight on and off and training at our heads and bodies. And, you know, the only thing you can do when that's happening is just sort of sit there and turn to stone and hold your hands up.
We're speaking with Karen DeVito, who has just made it out of Israeli detention on the cruise of the ship Tahrir to Gaza. And you and your fellow passengers and crew were subjected to what sounds like water torture with the cannons into which you were forced to march at the front or other parts of the boat.
Well, that wasn't the worst of it for us. We were able to hide behind the wheelhouse. We got a bit wet. Yes, it was uncomfortable. It got dark. We got cold. But we saw the Irish boat with two water cannons trained on it, and they were just filling it up. The Irish women who were on the Sirsha told us later, because we were all in the same cell block, that there was a great danger there. All the windows were smashed, the electricals were shorted out, and the engine room was filling up with water.
The incident, did that take place in Israeli coastal territory or international waters?
It was 50 miles offshore. So I guess that would be international waters.
What happened next in taking you and your colleagues involuntarily into Israeli territory, Israeli detention, abduction, as it were? How did you get to land? What was that like, and what happened when you landed?
Our ship was driven on its own power. We requested to be taken below because it was really getting cold in the night, and as we walked through the cabin, which had several tables and benches, a dozen actually, we saw that what they said was going to be a search just looked like a frat house after a wild party. All our belongings were just thrown all over the place. The place was trashed. All the journalist equipment was thrown on the floor. Computers were cracked. Cameras were all over the place.
Were they examined for espionage reasons, or data taken away?
Were they examined? I don't know. One soldier asked us, where is the medical aid? Asked one of the men, where is the medical aid? He didn't know. I cooked in that galley every day looking at the medical aid. Several days after we were arrested, an IDF spokesperson, I'm told, said we had no medical aid. Finally, I guess, the IDF searched the cartons that said tuna and beans. So the thorough search, I'm not sure what that really meant.
You know. What kind of jail or holding facility were you put in, and what kinds of indignities, tortures, lack of access, involuntary abduction to Israel, or other legal and humane anomalies did you experience?
Well, we were taken to Givon Detention Center. Of course, the men and women were separated. Three of us, two American women and myself, were in one cell. The Irish women were in another. At times, we could be in a corridor together. There was another wing that we could hear, not see, that had other women who were to be deported. And as it turned out, little children, too. We thought we were next to a school, but when we peeked through the crack in the door and through the keyhole, we could see that children were in there as well. Now, you know, you understand that prison is prison. I don't think that it was worse than prison anywhere else. From the moment we arrived, nothing we were told was true. There were games played with you know, food, with blankets, with there was no heat, with whether or not we'd be allowed to make a phone call. I was held for 48 hours before I got to make a phone call. I believe that our ambassadorial representative arranged that. There were mind games 24 hours a day, all through the night. Men would walk into our cells with female guards at any time of day or night, smoking cigarettes. We were expected to get out of bed and stand up for them. But, you know, we were the lucky ones. We internationals were the lucky political prisoners. We had some consular representatives, some ambassadors working for us. We had our loved ones who could contact our politicians at home. There are thousands of Palestinian political prisoners being held right now who have no contact with their family, not for a few days, for months, sometimes years, and no one to watch over them. So me, as a fair-skinned old lady with gray hair, I was lucky. But many people are not. The people in our detention facility appeared to be Asian or African. So It is a deportation center, from what I understand. So I don't think we were in with the rest of the political prisoners. But the lawyer who came to see us, who was Palestinian herself, and by the time 3 days of this was up, it was hard to believe anyone. So it took a while before we believed that she was who she said she was.
He told
us that Palestinian political prisoners usually do not sign any documents for the first meeting, perhaps not for two.
We're speaking with Karen DeVito, who has just emerged from Israeli captivity, from her journey on the ship Tahrir en route before abduction to Gaza. And Karen, I understand there is a most Orwellian perplexing procedure in regard to your being kidnapped to Israel and then being coerced into signing a statement of your purported criminality for being kidnapped. Can you explain what this document is that we hear about?
Well, you can choose not to sign. The entire Irish ship chose not to sign anything. We were taken to what we later learned was court. It looked like a government office. There was a man with a computer. There was another man helping, showing him where to click. There were documents in Hebrew that we were asked to sign. We were told that the translation, there was a translation of these documents. There was an English document. We were told they were the same. I did not sign that document. But basically what the English document said was this. You are here for entering Israel, residing in Israel illegally. If you sign this document and you also waive your right to appeal deportation, you will be deported within 24 hours. If you sign and you don't waive your rights for deportation, you wait 72 hours to be deported. One of our people, Ihab Lotayev, signed that document that night. I think he's being released tonight. That was the last I heard. But he's been held all this time, even though he did sign. So everything about it was completely perverse. Sign, don't sign. Nothing seemed to make any difference. Nothing you did made any difference. So I was presented with another document. Finally, the women made collective decisions. Nobody left without talking to other people. So at the time that I was ready to go, the release of the two American women was being negotiated and looked like it was going to happen.
Go ahead.
Yes. You don't know until you're actually on the aircraft and it's taken off.
Who paid for that flight?
My husband did.
Why?
Well, I guess he loves me.
Well,
we offered to pay for it.
Yes, that's a beautiful thing. And I understand that others were placed in circumstances where they were put in a situation of incurring additional expenses because of the means of their expulsion following their abduction into Israeli custody. Karen, we hear that there were on the order of 27 people engaged in this Gaza trip. How are your colleagues, the captains, the crew, how much are you able to know so far about the fate of the others?
The captains were released. As it stands now, I understand that Ihab Lotayev and David Heap are being released tonight. They may even be on their way home to Canada at this moment. There are two more, the Australian, Michael Coleman, and the journalist from the UK, may be deported to Turkey, but we don't know yet. They were threatened with two more months of prison, even though Ihab had signed. So, as far as I know, definitely the 14 Irish people from the Saoirse are still in prison. They have refused to sign. They have demanded that the government of Israel deport them and pay for their affair. And their consul has been working very hard on this. The ambassador himself was on the dock in Ashdod when we arrived.
Well, that's the issue that I was alluding to, that if one is taken out of one's legal journey and placed in a situation not of their intent, I don't see why they should be held financially responsible for what some analysts would call piracy on the high seas.
Yes, well, apparently the Irish government takes this more seriously. They had a representative there every day, and it's because of him that we got free association with the other women, the right to be outdoors, the right to see our comrades from time to time. The Canadian mission was very helpful to us. Came to see me, oversaw the purchase of the ticket, passed messages to John for me, did what they could, said, of course, I'm working at a disadvantage here. The American representative was a little more specific. He said, I am powerless here.
Karen,
to me, it looks like what we have here is not necessarily an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Those are not really the two sides. It looks like the two sides are on one side, Israel with support from Canada and the U.S. on one side, and the rest of the world on the other.
Karen DeVito, you are a leader, and certainly you and your husband John and all the others who've been engaged in these trips have put bodies and souls, spirits, and information on the line in the hope of equity, justice, sovereignty, and rights for Palestine and the people of Gaza and the affiliated people. What advice would you give to those who have not taken the same journey as you, but who think they may be of a similar spirit? What advice do you bring the world after your experience on the Tahrir?
Well, Robert, I'm not big on giving anyone advice, but I can tell you this much. I'm just an ordinary person who one day decided to take action. And right now, all over the world, hundreds of thousands of ordinary people are becoming activists in one way or another. So, and hundreds of thousands of activists are working on this issue, too. So, people are doing things like organizing ships on this issue to sail. That might not be the way the next wave goes, but there will be more ships. There'll be ships. Maybe there'll be arranged tours into Gaza from some other way. But we're working to change the behavior of the state of Israel. People can look for their local boycott, the vast sanction group. There are boycott movements for consumer boycotts of fruits and vegetables, cosmetics produced in Israel. There's corporate and individual divestment from Israeli companies. This is a big one, and it's really growing. Then there are protests at cultural events. And that is, we support the arts, but we don't support what's happening in Israel. So we support the artists, but not apartheid. So at whatever level a person wants to become engaged, they can. And even though if it's only the level of saying, I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this with other people instead of being too afraid to speak up about it, too afraid to learn about it, to read about it, and to speak their mind. This is what's happening now. It's growing. Look at the Occupy movement. Ordinary people are doing this. They're taking the steps. So, ordinary people, keep doing what you're doing.
Karen DeVito.
Freedom rules the waves. Israel waves the rules.
And you are engaged in an armada of freedom. And we thank you so much for sharing these tender moments with us today.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you for having me.
Best regards to John as well.
Thank you.
Karen DeVito, speaking with us live from Istanbul, Turkey, after her ordeal under Israeli abductions from the high seas on the ship Tahrir, one of two ships that was on its way to Gaza.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. Tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. Their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn. Spirit will never die. We will not go down to Gaza tonight. Tonight.
We will not go down. The Gaza song composed and performed by Michael Hart. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh.